You're listening to 89.5 FM WPKN in Bridgeport. Stay tuned for In Context, coming up next.
Welcome to In Context, WPKN's live public affairs call-in program. This is Ken McDermott-Rowe, and I'm here with my co-host, Gus Contivero.
Hello, good evening.
Today we're going to talk about how the escalating cost of college tuition is crushing college students and their parents. We'll be opening the phone lines in a few minutes to get your views on this issue. But first, we're going to get some perspective from our guest, Professor Andrew Hacker. Professor Hacker is the co-author with Claudia Dreyfus of the book Higher Education? How Colleges Are Wasting Our Money and Failing Our Kids, and What We Can Do About It. Professor Hacker, thanks very much for joining us on In Context.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Glad to have you.
Professor, let me start with an example close to home. In 1969, the cost of a four-year degree at the University of Connecticut, a public institution, was less than $10,000, whether you were an in-state or an out-of-state student. Currently, the cost of that same degree is about $100,000 for an in-state student and an incredible $168,000 for an out-of-state student. What has caused this astronomical tuition increase?
Well, to sum it up very briefly, there used to be an old phrase, spending like a drunken sailor. Well, that's what our institutions of higher education have been doing. They have been taking on all sorts of activities ranging from volleyball teams to campuses in far-flung parts of the world, and increasingly also allowing their faculty, encouraging their faculty to do anything but teaching.
You note that at Williams College, where the tuition now is about $54,000, I just checked yesterday, for the academic year starting this fall, over 70% of the staff is engaged in non-teaching functions like fundraising and admissions. How does this figure into the cost?
Fundraising and admissions, or indeed just take the football team. Williams is not a, you know, great national power. There are more football coaches at Williams than there are professors in the philosophy department. Now, that's what drives up the cost. It's up to Williams as to whether they want to have football, but if they want to have that big a staff, they're going to have fewer professors for the students.
Now, I'm glad you bring up the issue of the sports, because that was one of the issues that I kind of focused on. When I was reading your book, it really just jumped out to me. I had never thought of it before. I'd always assumed that colleges make their money back on the money that they put into the sports programs. But you know, you made a point of saying that there nationally the sports runs a $3.6 billion deficit. So I did a little more research into that, and I looked up how much the coaches at some of the headline schools make. And I found an article, I think it's from the Wall Street Journal, and it said that 56 coaches in 2007 made $1 million or more dollars. And I looked it up, and the top earners, whereas USC's Pete Carroll made $4.4 million, Ohio State's Jim Tressel made $2.6 million, Iowa's Kirk Ferentz made $3.4 million, and you know, recently we had the Final Four, or the NCAA tournament going on for basketball, and Kentucky's John Calipari made $4 million this year. That's a humongous amount of money. Are the tuitions having to pay for these salaries?
Yes, they are. The colleges engage in creative bookkeeping to try to persuade you that their football program makes money. But in fact, when you add in amortizing the stadium, which was recently built with its skyboxes and all the rest, you discover that in fact it's your own tuition. If you're a student or you're a parent, it's your tuition that is subsidizing athletics. And by the way, not just high-priced football. Take the University of Texas, which has a volleyball team. Now, we're all in favor of volleyball. It's a nice game.
Everyone likes sports, sure.
The typical, the average volleyball player costs the University of Texas $56,000 a year.
Wow.
That's so they can travel to tournaments in Hawaii, you know, that sort of thing. And once again, that adds on to the tuition.
So, you know, I have to ask, because You mentioned how some of the schools, they say how much it costs to educate a student. And one of the schools you quote says that they spend $70,000 per student to educate them. Does that include the cost of maintaining these sports teams?
It includes the sports teams, but it also includes what might be called phantom faculty. Take Williams College that you just mentioned.
Okay.
By the way, there used to be something called sabbaticals. Remember that? Every 7 years
sure.
off?
Yes.
Now at Williams, I call them trilaterals. Mm-hmm. The professor gets every third year off, which means that about a third of the faculty aren't present at any given time.
You say that they live in an alternate reality.
Indeed. And they claim that their research is terribly, terribly necessary, as if, you know, it's going to be a cure for cancer around the corner. Let's give one example. We've all heard of William Faulkner, you know, great American author. In a recent 15-year period, I'm now going to tell you how many papers and articles by professors were written on William Faulkner. 14 years. 2,718. Now, really, do we really need all that knowledge?
You also point out that often the courses are on very minute subjects.
So abstract.
Because it fits in with the professor's research ambitions. So it's really of little value to the students, but it summarizes perhaps his notes in some arcane project.
Absolutely. At Stanford University, it's a good university, at least we're told it is, the history department offers, are you ready, 229 separate courses for undergraduates. That's history at Stanford, 229 courses. What are the courses on? The history of tobacco, for example, the decline and fall of Yugoslavia. In other words, the professor is just reading his notes for his new research project or the galleys of his next article.
I would think that some of those topics are so minute and specialized that they couldn't possibly apply to an undergraduate degree.
Well, I would like to think that a history major at Stanford would come out knowing something about the general contours of history of the United States, of various continents in the world. But if you're going to have 12 classes like the ones I just mentioned, what do you really know?
Now, I have another question for you. Given the current economy and the job market, it's pretty obvious we all know the depths and severity of it. I've personally known people who've gone to NYU and Duke for degrees in teaching. And now I have to ask the question, given the cost of those degrees, because I had no idea how much they cost until recently. Ken's been educating me more about the cost of tuition, because I had no idea. My whole college education cost me $24,000, and I went to a small state school. So I didn't understand it at all, that there was a possibility of spending $50,000 a year. So, but the teaching jobs out there are very hard to come by. They're getting laid off left and right, but they come in a set scale where you start out at a certain degree and you cap off at a certain degree. And most of them start between $32,000 and $40,000 in most parts of the country. Do you have a metric as to what your degree should cost you as compared to what the proposed job that you would like to get will pay you?
Well, first of all, one of the things we point out in the book, and we cite several examples, are places where you can get a very good, excellent education at the lowest possible cost. And by this, we don't mean, do they used to have the phrase, you get your degree off a matchbook cover? We're not talking about, proprietary colleges or anything like that. One good way to start is by spending your first 2 years, pick it up carefully, at a community college, two-year college. All of them have liberal arts departments with good liberal arts professors. You can get a very good start in your first 2 years at such a college. And by the way, the classes are quite small, whereas at Mega U, you'll have several hundred in your class.
Right, right.
You can then transfer as a junior to a regular state university, which they're quite prepared to do that. They're ready for it. And then continue. And in the end, you'll have, I would say, a minimal educated. I would say you could get your total degree for about $36,000,
$40,000. Okay.
You're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 Bridgeport, and we're speaking with Professor Andrew Hacker about the escalating cost of college tuition. If you'd like to join our conversation, our call-in number is 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756.
Ken, actually, did you have a question about the student loan bubble that you wanted to go to? I thought that was a pretty good topic.
I don't know if you're familiar with the writing of the economist Richard Vedder, but he seems to believe that one of the reasons for the tuition increase, perhaps the principal reason, has to do with the availability of borrowed money. So it's created something like a bubble that we saw in the housing industry. What do you think of that view?
First of all, Professor Vedder is totally on the mark. He is totally right, and people should listen to him because he's an economist and knows what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
What is the rising tuition has been based on the availability of loans, and colleges have said, okay, we're charging $40,000 as a private place is, or $17,000-$18,000 as a public university is, go take out a loan. Now, this is new. Students didn't used to take out loans. Either their parents would have a college fund or tuition was considerably lower. We now have people graduating at the age of 22 with sometimes six-figure indebtedness. And by the way, even if they say, hey, your loans are only $30,000, once you add in interest, penalties, late payments, it's going to get up to six figures.
Right.
So professors, they're not exactly the heroes in our book. The professors who are making very good salaries for very little teaching are doing this on the backs of young people.
And you point out that many of these professors have very light loads. There's something called, what's a 1-2 schedule? Could you describe that?
Well, in your state, I believe there's a university called Yale.
Yes, there is. We've heard of it.
You've heard of it. If you're a full professor there in a department like economics or psychology, you teach one course in one semester, two in the other. And by the way, one of the courses, even two of them, can be a small seminar with just 12 people around a table. This means that in the end, the number of hours per year that you have to, I'm talking hours per year, you have to show up at a given place and given time, might be less than 200.
And you also pointed out that much of the teaching duties are taken up by adjuncts, and you cite one poor gentleman, Matt Williams, who's a professor of English at the University of Akron, that he made $8.65 an hour.
Oh, what a horrible story.
With
that
no
was.
Prospect for promotion.
I remember that part.
None at all. And he had to live in his car, commuting among various campuses. And by the way, Matt will be teaching a course, let's say, in, I'm not going to say history of tobacco, but let's say he's teaching an introductory course in world politics.
Mm-hmm.
In the very next classroom will be a tenured professor teaching exactly the same course, getting six times as much as the adjunct. They're teaching exactly the same course.
Now, that you going into the area of tenure, I want to go back to my education, which I'm only 28. It hasn't been that long ago. I graduated in 2005, but a lot of the professors that I had the most fondness for were adjuncts, and you mentioned that in the book. My experience with the tenured professors was very mixed. Some of the tenured professors almost seemed like it was sort of a bother.
Yeah.
The interest, like, I don't even know how they became tenured, because they completely lacked the ability to relate to another human being. It just seems like I don't get it. Like,
it was a low priority.
Low priority, but like they didn't even understand what it meant to have a relationship with a person. It was like they came in and it was like we were a room full of dogs or something, and they just had to, keep us occupied for a couple hours.
When we were going around the country collecting material for the book, we every time we went to a college, and we went to several dozen, we always asked to sit in a class.
Uh-huh.
And we sat in dozens of classes, some of them with the kind of professors you talked about. There was one professor, he didn't even know the students were there. The kids would raise their hands, and he kept talking. And they are promoted to this, by the way, I don't even want to call it tenure. I call it lifetime employment. You can keep that job until you carry it out in a box. And they get it either because of research or collegiality, or I'll tell you one reason why they get promoted to tenure. The colleges went through a big rigmarole in hiring them as assistant professors, interviews, that presentations, and they figured, gee, after doing all that, we can't get rid of him, you know, too much trouble, so they keep him on.
Because, I mean, I could tell you that specifically amongst my classmates where we would fill out the student evaluation forms for one professor in particular, and he was a great guy outside of the classroom, but he just had no idea how to teach people. And, you know, the evaluation forms every single time was, this guy has no idea how to teach. What's he doing here?
And he was back the next year?
He was always back, yeah. I just think that it was like when they questioned him outside, it was like, and he would just say, well, the kids are idiots. You know, I think that's what his reason was.
You're listening to In Context. If you'd like to join our conversation about college tuition increases with Professor Andrew Hacker, our phone number is 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. Well, I had a situation in a famous law school where we had a professor. I was on the appointments committee.
You're not going to name it?
I will not name it. And this gentleman came up for tenure, and he was the most popular teacher in the law school. He taught at 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, and no one ever missed the class. It was standing room only, taught evidence. And when he came up for his tenure evaluation, he got completely panned by the committee. Another reason why, it was pure jealousy. These other guys were there, they had research credentials, but they were terrible teachers. And
that's,
I'm sure,
right. And they felt threatened by him. And they probably accused him of being a popularizer and an entertainer.
Exactly. They denigrated his academic credentials because he was popular, because he was a good teacher.
Wow.
So he got the thumbs down.
It really made me upset to find out what the adjuncts earn. Because when I was in college, you know, as a freshman, almost all the freshman courses were taught by adjuncts. I didn't even know what an adjunct was. You know, I was an 18-year-old kid. And, I mean, most of us were still saying Mr. So-and-so to the name, and they were just like, call me Bill, you know. but that was what the level we were on. We were still in high school. But it really made me upset to learn the kind of disrespect that they get. Now, looking back on it, I think I understand some of the signs that I saw.
Well, one of the reasons so many of the courses are taught by adjuncts is, first, the senior professors, again, we're talking about tenure, they can do whatever they like, they refuse to teach the introductory course. And the second is that the senior professors absorb so much of the faculty budget. The typical full professor now is getting over $100,000 a year. They absorb so much of the budget that there's very little left over, so they hire these, you know, peon wage adjuncts.
How would you shake that system up if you could? Would you eliminate the tenure system? Or how would you bring some rationality to this?
We'd absolutely eliminate tenure. We'd say, give people a 5-year contract, you know, like other adults have.
Right. Earn it on your merits.
That's right.
So what about, you made another point of pointing out the beautification projects, shall we say, to the universities, where you mentioned one university that has a 5-story climbing wall in the gymnasium, and, you know, these 15-lane swimming pools, and, you know, these astronomical, which college had a $40 million sports facility?
Oh, this was Kenyon.
Kenyon
Ball
University.
College, right?
That's right. I've been to a number of universities in my job. I travel a bit, and I've seen Bowdoin College up in, Maine, I think?
That's it.
And I was pretty impressed, but obviously, just as visiting, I didn't realize, you know, this costs money. And it just seems like they're trying to make it look like a 5-star resort to attract students instead of students coming to get educated.
By the way, did you stop for lunch at Bowdoin College?
Yes, I did.
Because they have a special chef who prepares Dijon chicken.
Unfortunately, I wasn't treated to that. I just had the sandwich. But
I figure for over $50,000 a year, you got to get breakfast in bed. You know, you mentioned Kenyon.
Turnover service, right?
And you cited a statistic in there which I think explodes the myth that most people get scholarships. You said that Kenyon, which is over $50,000, over one half of the students pay the full tuition, and 62% have to borrow money.
This is right. And, in fact, what has happened is that in all of the colleges, half of the students pay tuition, the full tuition. In other words, they have parents who are, you know, surgeons and corporate lawyers and hedge fund traders and all that. There are enough, as we know, a lot of money has been whooshing upward in our economy. And they can pay the full tuition, and therefore they get preference in admission.
We only have a few minutes left in our show, but if you'd like to join the conversation, we're speaking about the college tuition crisis with Professor Andrew Hacker, and our phone number is 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756.
So the big question, with all of this money going to this overinflated service, it's costing far too much money. People are going into massive amounts of debt to pay for it, and they're coming out and finding no jobs as a result of it. Are we better off as a society with the massive inflation of cost in education? Are people smarter?
Okay. First of all, there will be jobs for college graduates.
Mm-hmm.
The unemployment rate for college graduates is less than half of it is for high school graduates.
Okay.
So they'll get jobs.
Okay.
I'm not worried about that. What I would say is that most people go to college not for the job, although they may say they do. They go to college to become, believe it or not, a college graduate, which marks you as a member of a certain class of American. In other words, there are two classes, those who have the degree and those who don't. And people really want to be above that line, you know, to have the BA.
Right.
And it also, they become a different sort of person in diction, demeanor, sophistication. I won't say they all know how to order wines, but they're getting close to it.
Can I interrupt you for just 1 second? We have a phone call.
Okay.
Caller, are you with us?
Hello, yes, I'm calling from Long Island.
Oh,
right,
that's
welcome.
Great. Go ahead.
In context, what's your question?
My question goes back to the getting rid of tenure comment a few minutes ago.
Uh-huh.
Wouldn't it be, I would like your comment on, instead of just using a five-year plan and then subjecting equally good faculty to the whims of whoever is at the helm of determining tenure or not, which keeps us in a fickle kind of situation that you're referring to.
Right.
Wouldn't it be more appropriate then to develop a staff development that would address these issues so that you would now have a long-term workforce that's working towards the goals that you might establish at the beginning?
So basically,
you know,
that would consist
of educational reform.
So basically,
rather than just letting people go after 5 years.
So, or just basically developing your talent from within. Is that
okay?
It's just like working with the labor force.
Right.
Well,
what do you think of that, Professor Hacker?
That's a fair question. Unfortunately, if people have tenure, you cannot make them go on to these development courses. We've watched this at various colleges. They've said to a tenured professor, look, your evaluations are really down in the pits.
Uh-huh.
Can we video your class and let's go over the tapes and in the film and see what you were doing and so on? The professor said, no, they've got tenure. They don't have to. Now, and it's lifetime employment.
Mm-hmm.
I would also say that we visited several colleges that do not have tenure, where the faculty don't have that guarantee. Some of them are state, like in Evergreen in Washington, Florida Gulf Coast, and the faculty morale is just as good. They don't worry about being victimized by administrators. I think there's a lot of myth about tenure.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
You mentioned that in 1940, only 10% of U.S. students earned college degrees. I think we're going to go back to those days.
No. People will continue to go to college for the reasons we just talked about a little while ago, and that is they want to become a college graduate. It's kind of, do we still use the word imprimatur? It kind of stamps them as having ascended to being a certain type of American.
That's true. I mean, everybody wants that status. Everybody should be afforded the ability to go to college. But what do we do when the cost of college is far more than most people in the lower and now middle class are going to be able to afford?
Well, if Claudia and I were asked to submit a program, we'd go to every college. And there used to be something called zero-based budgeting, which you have to defend everything from the ground up.
Uh-huh.
We'd say, except for classroom instruction, we want you to defend everything. the volleyball team, the Dijon chicken, the 15-lap swing pool. Everything on
right.
the defensive.
Right.
I think I sound like some Republicans in Congress. Well, hey,
why not? It seems to me the taxpayers have a right because all of these universities receive taxpayer support one way or the other. Why shouldn't the government go to the colleges and say, look, if you want to continue to get taxpayer benefits through guaranteed loans or research grants or whatever, you're going to have to start rolling back your tuition and living within your means, just like American families.
Hey, we're saying that to the medical establishment. We should say it to the educational one, too.
It's kind of hard, though, to have downward pressure on tuition as long as there's so much demand for room in the schools. You know, everybody wants to go, so there's really no reason for the schools to roll back their tuition, right?
Well, there's plenty of room because a lot of colleges take virtually anyone who applies.
Okay.
And by the way, some of those colleges are really very good. There are what are called regional state universities, you know, not the flagship.
Uh-huh.
And we visited quite a few of them. The faculty are very dedicated. They're never going to leave for Harvard because Harvard's never heard of them. And you can get a good education there and something else. If you get to know some professors there and they write you strong letters, you will be accepted by Harvard Law School. Harvard Law School is looking for talent from all over the country.
If you'd like to join our conversation, we're just coming to the end of a very interesting discussion with Professor Andrew Hacker about the escalating cost of college. Give us a ring at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756.
Mr. Hacker, do you have any comments on the... you did have a portion of your book dedicated to college loans. Yeah. And how the interest rates kind of disproportionately affect the lower classes because they have to borrow a lot more, and obviously they're seen as more of a risk. Do you have any comments on how we could address the borrowing for a college education or anything like that?
Well, part of this will have to be done by Congress in one way or another because
mm-hmm.
At this point, the banks, which originally made most of the loans. First of all, they've got the guarantee. If you default, the taxpayers will make it up. But also, if you've got a huge college loan, over $100,000, and you have to, you can't declare bankruptcy.
Right.
So you have this, you know, you have to pay this off or you want.
It seems like we're creating a generation of virtual serfs who are going to be in kind of wage slaves the rest of their lives paying off this college debt. And I understand that once you go in arrears, you have all these penalties, and the lenders don't actually mind it so much if you go in arrears because they can just keep tacking on the higher interest and the penalties, knowing you can never discharge it.
And they will automatically, believe it or not, it's hard to believe, dock your Social Security, your income tax refunds, and later your Social Security benefits. Can you imagine that?
It's a lifetime problem, and there's also the problem, is there not, of parents really having to go through their life savings and sometimes grandparents in order to bail out these colleges?
Well, one thing, in the past, parents were much more frugal, Protestant ethic, whatever, thrifty, and they did put aside funds for their kids. A lot of parents did that, college funds. And there's less of that now. I'm not sure why, because a lot of the students taking out loans really do come from families where the parents, I think, should have been putting something aside.
Well, it doesn't look like the tuition's going to be coming down anytime soon, but I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Professor Hacker, thanks so much for being
Thank
with
you
us
for
today
joining
in
us.
Context.
Well, I've really enjoyed this, Ken and Gus, and hey, let's talk again sometime.
That'd be
let's
great.
Do that.
Take care.
Right. Take care. Bye.
You're listening to In Context, WPKN's live call-in show at 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm one of your hosts, Ken McDermott-Rowe, and I'm here with the other host,
Gus Cantavero.
And we've been speaking today about escalating college costs with Professor Andrew Hacker, co-author with Claudia Dreyfus of the book Higher Education: How Colleges Are Wasting Our Money and Failing Our Kids, and What We Can Do About It. This program will be archived at our website, www.incontextreport.com, where you can read our blog, watch our videos, make comments, and sign up for announcements and podcasts. And we do have a new video up there,
We do. The new video up there now is called Outsmart Your Cancer, and it's based on our interview last month with Tanya Harder Pierce, where there was a lot of interest in that interview. And in addition, the podcast is also on the website. So if you missed that broadcast and you want to download it, you can go up there and find it. And the next edition of In Context TV, our video series, is going to be on the show that you just heard, on the college tuition crisis, and that'll be online in the next few weeks.
In Context is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., and is broadcast on the first Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. and the first Sunday of the month at 10 p.m. So please join us on Sunday, May the 1st at 10 p.m., where we'll discuss NATO's global wars with geopolitical analyst Rick Rozoff. And on Wednesday, May the 4th, at 6:30 p.m. during WPKN's fundraising drive, when we'll discuss alternative cancer cures and offer as a premium the book Outsmart Your Cancer by our recent guest, Tanya Harder Pierce. Thanks very much for listening. Please stay tuned for Chris Teske, who is coming up next.
See ya.